Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, pulling away the veils of America's top secret military research agency, DARPA, that's D-A-R-P-A, and updates on Area 51. One guest today, Annie Jacobson. Annie is an independent journalist and author who writes about war, weapons, national security, government secrecy, and the military history. She is a former contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times magazine, received her education at Princeton University, and her first major book was Area 51, an extensive history of the U.S.'s secret military base in the Nevada desert, which became a national bestseller and was translated many languages and even a television series. This was followed up by Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, voted one of the best books of 2014 by the Boston Globe. It's perhaps the most thorough study on the subject in print with new information from Annie's Freedom of Information request. Her most recent book, just released, is The Pentagon's Brain, The Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. Her website is anniejacobson.com. Nice to have you this day, Annie.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to begin with having you provide some historical background into the origins and reasons for the creation of the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more commonly known as DARPA. Many have heard this acronym, but few people really have an idea what's actually happening. Yet, as you and others have defined it, DARPA is the Pentagon's brain, and what it does has had far more influence and impact on our lives during the past half century than we realize. So please give us a history about who created DARPA, why was it created, and what was its original goals and mission, and when was it created and why? Then we can explore this more deeply.
So DARPA was created in 1958, and it was a direct result of Sputnik, that 23-inch sphere that was the world's first satellite. And when you think about Sputnik, or if you sort of visualize this seemingly harmless satellite, you might wonder, well, what is really all the fuss? But the real fuss was the fact that for Sputnik to be launched up into orbit, it had to be put there by a Soviet missile. The same kind of missile that would be capable of carrying a thermonuclear warhead in its nose cone from the Soviet Union to the United States, most likely to Washington, D.C. And so with the lofting of Sputnik, the Soviets had in essence not just won the space race, they had taken pole position in the dreaded ICBM race. And the Pentagon's response was to create an agency with a specific mandate that it could never allow for any nation to take America by technological surprise. That is what DARPA was specifically set up to do, and that is what DARPA has done in all the decades since. It has always maintained military supremacy over the rest of the world.
Would you share some of our government's debacles with nuclear weapons, and in particular with the development of a hydrogen bomb, and some of the scattered-brained ideas that a nuclear explosion can be used for constructive peaceful purposes? Now the Obama administration is intent on rebuilding our nuclear arsenal up to $1 trillion, and I've even heard one figure going much higher. And why are we still witnessing this same perverted mindset that was being entertained back in the 1950s and 60s?
Well, it's a great question, and unfortunately, I believe the answer is quite simple. I'm going to give you a short version of it. So it's why I begin the book with, it's quite simple, but it's also it's often made very complicated. And the simple version is that the reason why we would be building new nuclear warheads is because there is no defense against the nuclear weapon. There never was, there never has been to date. And so this idea I believe, is often just, you know, to move the ball around. In other words, let's create more. It's an appearance of supremacy. But I begin the book specifically 4 years before DARPA's creation in 1954 in the Marshall Islands on an island called Bikini, where the largest nuclear weapon ever exploded to date at then was called Castle Bravo. And it was exploded with a force of 15 megatons. I tell the story through the eyes of two of the individuals, the nuclear weapons engineers who were there. And it's really shocking to kind of feel it firsthand. The reason why I think this was so significant, and it ties in with DARPA, is because, you know, the story that I write in the Pentagon's brain is really about man and machine. And it's important to think that a nuclear weapon is a machine. It is engineered. And the scientists, the very scientists who designed and engineered Castle Bravo, had warned President Truman that it should not be built. They actually called it an evil thing. They wrote that in an addendum to the president. But it was built anyways, and I begin the book in this moment that it's about to explode. And really, DARPA was created because it had to figure out how to defend against a weapon against which there is no defense, which sounds absolutely crazy, like a closed Mobius loop, which it is. And the answer to that is to create more weapon systems so that you have this underlying idea, which I pull through the book, which was first presented by Eisenhower in 1961, the idea of the military-industrial complex, that for every weapon system, there is a built-in obsolescence. So there is also a requirement that defending against that weapon system will require more weapons.
I checked on the defense budgets for the major militarized countries listed on the International Institutes of Strategic Studies website. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the U.S. has held the distinctive role of being the planet's only supermilitary power. It's capable of waging a one-nation war upon the entire world. Now, there's two budgets. One is the official budget of $610 billion, and there's the unofficial budget that's anywhere between $1.4 and $1.6 trillion. And increasingly, the hawks in Washington identify our two greatest enemies as Russia and China. And yet their combined defense budgets is just a little over $200 billion, a third of the U.S.'s, and that's the official budget. Even Saudi Arabia's budget is larger than Russia's. And I understand it. DARPA devises and plans the weapons of the future, that's what you just said, looking out as long as 2050. And in many respects, it has been doing this for over two decades without any formidable enemy. And although there have been noteworthy DARPA inventions that have revolutionized public life, such as the internet and the computer mouse and various energy-related technologies, global positioning systems we use in our automobiles, the fact of the matter is that everything being done at DARPA is not to improve humans' quality of life, but to strengthen military defense and offense. And we spend enormous amounts of tax dollars to do this. And before we look at some of the more secret projects being conducted at DARPA, explain the government and the Pentagon's current mindset for placing so much importance on this agency and how much of it it's economic, since DARPA itself is a very small agency and the majority of all of its work is contracted out to private research corporations. So politicians have a financial incentive to support these contracts to firms in their states. Now, I think the budget is over $3 billion annually. So what is currently being done with that?
Well, you've hit upon a couple different important points, all of which kind of thread together. So for starters, absolutely, the American government spends more money on its military than all the world combined. However, that is a public figure. And I would not believe any kind of figure that comes out of China or comes out of Russia as far as military budgets are concerned, simply because they do not have a free press in either of those nations. So there is absolutely no way of verifying what that information is. So there is just no way to know what they are really spending. What we do know, in part, is what America spends. And again, you are absolutely correct in saying in part, because this is just, you know, the budget that is made known to Congress. There are certainly black budgets. I write about them in my previous two books. As far as DARPA's $3 billion annual spending, let's look at that number for a second, and then maybe it'll help listeners understand, like, how DARPA works and why it's so powerful, and whether or not that is a double-edged sword, as I present. So of that $3 billion, consider this. DARPA has only 120 program managers. That's an average number, but that's the same average number that has existed since it began in 1958, as is the $3 billion figure adjusted for inflation. So you, if you divide those one number by the other, you can see how much money and power and influence those individual program managers have. What they then do is the individual program managers reach out to academic laboratories, to other military laboratories, and to private industry, private corporations, private businesses, to build their research and development programs. And what I think is most interesting about all of this is that it's essentially completely unknown to most people. So you have an incredibly powerful organization in the Defense Department responsible for all the major research and development. And we're talking pre-requirement research, so requirement 10, 20 years ahead of time. And yet, very few people even know it exists. And that was really my primary purpose in the book, was to say, you know, maybe it would be a good idea to have a little bit of an idea of what's going on there. And then people can form their own conclusions about what they think that really means in terms of the bigger defense budget.
Would you briefly provide us with insight on the major private corporations that are most heavily engaged in DARPA government contracts to conduct research? And are there certain think tanks, such as RAND, that are closely associated with the agency?
Yes, well, they all are. I mean, there are, you know, and as I write in the book, it sort of ebbs and flows with who's popular at the Pentagon. As you're absolutely right, in the book I write about how popular RAND was, and RAND was really relied upon during Vietnam. And during the War on Terror, that was not as much the case. But as far as the private corporations go, they also ebb and flow. Consider this. A partnership was just made between the Secretary of Defense and 100 of the biggest tech companies in Silicon Valley. You can look to the same situation in biotechnology, in information technology. This is the way in which the agency works, that anyone who's at the top of their game, any academic laboratory or civilian, you know, research organization that's privately funded, DARPA wants them in their stable, because DARPA always must stay ahead of the curve.
Got it. I'd like to share a story with you, a true story, and see if this in any way connects with your research and DARPA or any of the other projects that are out there that are off-the-book projects. I was giving a lecture to the WPFW audience, where I've been on the radio for 31 years, 5 days a week, on PFW in Washington, D.C., or Pacifica Sister Station. And I was doing a fundraising lecture at this civic center. It was packed to the gills. And afterwards, as I was saying goodbye to people, this one man waited and waited and waited. And I saw him waiting for about an hour. And when everyone else was gone, he came over. And he said, I just thought I'd share something with you, because something that you've been saying on the radio over the years and something you mentioned today really struck home with me. He said, I'm going to tell you a story. You won't know who I am. We won't see each other again. But I want you to know that you are way off. You are so wrong by 99.9% in underestimating the corruption that goes on. I said, well, explain where I'm wrong. He said, let me tell you how it works. Let's just say that this morning at 5 o'clock, there were a group of young and middle-aged men playing racquetball in a private facility. No cameras, no audio, no computers, just a friendly game. But after and during that friendly game, there was a discussion about can a piece of legislation be impacted. And the person who was asking was a lobbyist for a firm, a military-industrial complex firm. And the person who was his partner in the racquetball game, where there would be no email and no phone conversations at all, was a chief of staff for a major U.S. legislator. And then if this piece of legislation was voted in the direction that the firm wanted, then the lobbyist, not the legislator, the lobbyist said, you know what it's like to be able to get a Black American Express card? That's a card that has no limit. To be able to have leased every year a brand new car of your choice. You want a BMW? What do you want? To be able to fly in a private jet to exotic locations. To be able to have a beautiful townhouse of your own choosing in the most exclusive areas of Georgetown. To be able to mix and mingle some of those powerful people in the world. To start at $500,000 a year plus, and know in 2 or 3 years you're making $2 million, and that will be for the rest of your life. And the reciprocation is, you never put it in writing, you never discuss it with anyone in the media. And he said, now, imagine, Gary, that conversation in different locations, under different circumstances, over lunch, over dinner, on a golfing outing, was done 10,000 times a day in Washington, D.C., then you're still grossly underestimating how much of this type of quid pro quo occurs. He said the difference is that in the government projects, they're forever. They're like herpes. That's what he told me. He said, so you will work whatever deal you have to get a general, a procurement officer, a top legislator, the head of a committee in your area. It might be banking. Hence, look at the people who came from Wall Street to become Secretary of the Treasury, like Robert Rubin and Timothy Geithner and Summers. He said, it's not by accident these people come from Wall Street. It's not by accident they come from Goldman Sachs. It's not by accident that the Glass-Steagall Act gets taken away. It's not by accident they get bailed out. All of this is based upon knowing they control every lever, every agency, every department in government, period. He says, now I'm a part of that, and I've been a part of it for over 30 years. So I'm telling you, friend, when you said on last week's show that Washington, D.C. is one giant overflowing septic toilet, should be flushed, you have no idea. Because if you left all the people who weren't self-serving, you could put them in a small stadium. Everyone else is a part of the system, and it's not going to change. Now, that's a conversation that I had with a person. I don't know if it was real or not as far as what he was telling me, but I've had other people confirm that Washington's all about opportunity, and once you're in on one of those government contracts, no matter how redundant, no matter how obsolete, no matter how worthless what you're building or creating is, it will keep getting rubber stamped. Everybody keeps getting a cost plus, so they become filthy rich, and they become part of that insider. Nobody wants to get up from the table because someone else will take their seat. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, as a journalist, that would fall in the category of hearsay for me, so I can't really comment on it. I mean, if an anonymous person came up and told me something like that, it would just sound like gossip. So I have no idea and would have no way of, it also seems very broad. I do also try to stay out of generalizations about corruption in politics because it doesn't serve a story that I'm trying to tell, which is giving you information based on declassified documents and firsthand witnesses' reports on the record about specific events and programs and places. And I try and let that tell the story. And what is interesting is people have many different interpretations of my story. I will give you one example. When I wrote Operation Paperclip, my last book, which was about the Nazi science program to bring the Nazi scientists to America after the war, I would sometimes appear with a certain political persuasion of folks on their radio, and they would say, thank God you wrote this book and showed the world that, you know, despite the moral compromise, this program was absolutely 100% necessary. We had to do it. It was a great thing we did it. Thank God we did it, period. And I'm paraphrasing, but you get the idea. Another group of people would have me on their radio show and would say, same book, same information, having read all the same things, would say, thank God you wrote this book and you showed what a moral outrage this is, and that no matter what, we should never have done it, ever, 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 period. So my point is that I think I'm the kind of journalist that likes to let others come to their own conclusions.
All journalists can start with whatever premise they want, but at the end of the day, every journalist, myself included, I've broken over 300 stories. We have to pull back and see, is this an anomaly? Is this a one-off? Is this a lone wolf situation? Or is this a part of a system? Has the system itself, has the culture, in order for people to advance, in order for people to get advantage of a situation, have they compromised? And that's what I'm looking for. So my statement was not to clarify whether the person was accurate. As I said, I have no way of knowing what he said was true or not true. But my other experiences in Washington, my other stories I've broken, have shown that there's a great many things happening at any given time that don't represent the best interest of the American public. And when you look carefully at the defense budget, and I've spoken with people who are part of that system, and I said, how much money should we spend each year necessary to truly defend us? Not to have encampments all over the world, all these bases, not to have all these redundant systems, just how much do we need? And the person who had expertise in the field said, no more than about $100 billion, and that would be a lot. So between what we need and what we're spending, and when I see a society that has destroyed infrastructure and the ghettoization of communities, when I see so many homeless children, hungry children, when I see so many people out of work or are working but not paid enough, but I see the people who are part of the military-industrial complex who have more than enough, and that's discretionary income, over 53% we're spending on them and not on other issues, then I try to look for something that combines these interests together. Do you see, is this just a single or maybe two or three or five companies that are doing this, or is this a part of the larger culture of the military contractors in Washington?
Well, there is one important point that one significant change that I came across in reporting this book that I will share with you that I think speaks to that. And it is about the who's advising the Pentagon, because a lot of times people say, where's Congress? How come they're not doing something about this? And of course, Congress are busy, the Congress individuals are busy doing other things, including getting reelected. And they're not necessarily taking time to, you know, go through a DARPA budget. And so I really believe often that it's the advisors, it's the inside advisors who are giving counsel about what programs to go forward with and what to pull back from. And I found a disturbing shift, and it goes like this. Starting in 1960, the Pentagon, specifically DARPA, it was then called ARPA, called upon a group of scientists known as the Jason scientists. And what's interesting about the Jasons is they're often in theory, in like sort of conspiracy theory circles. The Jasons are often seen as these sort of like wicked wizards, you know, that they have, you know, some kind of power. They're right up there with the Illuminati, allegedly, you know, making these wicked ideas. That's at least how they were presented to me before I actually tracked some of them down and interviewed them, including the founder of the Jasons, a man named Marvin Goldberger, who just died, who was also on the Manhattan Project. But I learned a very interesting thing about the Jasons that might speak to your point, which is that they were actually, and they continue to be, full-time academics. So for the most part, they're working at universities, usually in, say, physics departments or biotech departments, say at Stanford, at Princeton, at Berkeley, at Harvard, at MIT, at UC San Diego, all over the country. Their full-time job is academia. Then they gather together in the summers to counsel, or to rather to tackle these hard defense problems that the Pentagon poses to them. You know, really big umbrella problems like what is, you know, originally it was how do we defend against the thermonuclear weapon. Later it was how do we defend against, you know, the Soviet bioweapons program that we just found out about. And many of the Jason's reports are classified, but many of them are declassified. And I read almost all of the ones that are declassified that I could get my hands on. And I saw that they were actually very, very detached scientific counsel to the Pentagon. You know, this is a good idea, this is not a good idea. They stayed out of why they thought it was a good idea. They really approached it from a scientific point of view. Well, when I got to the end of my book, and I'm bringing the reader up to the current day through the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and looking at where the Pentagon is now as it's moving toward robotic warfare. DARPA is building a swarm of drones, an army of drones, drones that can not just fly, but walk and crawl and swim, and submersible drones and space drones, all kinds of drones. That the plan is, the Pentagon's plan, which is in place, unclassified, is to move toward hunter-killer robots that are autonomous, that go out, assassinate targets, and then bring, you know, come home, in essence. That's the short version of it. And what I found was that the Jason scientists were opposed to this kind of movement. And when I asked one of the major players at DARPA, you know, what he thought about this, that even the Jason scientists say this is a bad idea, he told me that the Jason scientists are hardly relevant anymore. And that was his actual quote. And he said that the Jason scientists had been replaced by a group at the Pentagon called the Defense Science Board, the DSB. And almost no one knows about the Defense Science Board. You can Google them right now and find so much information about them, but they're certainly not in the public eye or the public awareness. But what I found in trying to interview the Defense Science Board scientists, all of whom declined interviews, was that, lo and behold, they're all on the board of defense contractors, the big defense contractors, Lockheed, Boeing, General Atomics, General Dynamics, IBM, and that these individuals, and many, many others, and that these individuals, unlike the Jason scientists who were full-time academics and part-time defense scientists, the new Defense Science Board are full-time defense contractors. That seems troubling to me, and that seems to speak from this reporter's eye to that closed loop that you're talking about, where a small group of people stands to gain financially from guiding the Pentagon in a way that only they can guide them.
I appreciate those insights on that. Thank you for that, Annie. Let me go back some years ago when I was writing a very important series, the first series in American literary history, challenging the corruption within the medical industrial complex. It was on the politics of cancer back in the early 1970s. And after the first article came out, I was sitting at the radio station, and on a Saturday afternoon, just finished doing my show, and I came out, and there was a man in the lobby, and we had a conversation, and he said, he was very specific. He told me that he was a medical doctor and an oncologist, and he said, I was listening to this four-hour expose you just did, and it bothered me because here's the point he made. He said, we are working in a system that rewards the people who go along with those who dictate the research. And if we challenge the research, the grants dry up, all the funding dries up, you won't get published. And he said, so what would you do if you have a family, you have financial responsibilities? Would you take on these people? Would you take their money and just do the research? He said, I said, well, it depends. Look at it this way. You're doing research. The likelihood is you're using chemotherapy. It's noble to try to find the cancer cure. No one questions that. But look at the failure and look at the number of people who get cancer because of the chemotherapy or die because of the treatment. And that's in the scientific literature. I've read over 3,000 studies on this. So if you're a part of that system that simply wants to be rewarded for your efforts and not for the results, then I would challenge it. And we had this discussion, and it was very specific. And today, when you look at the war on cancer, you see that that conversation could have been had 1,000 times more, because recently on 60 Minutes, a group of oncologists, all respected, none of them believing in the natural approach. These were all orthodox people. But what they didn't believe in was the fact that a patient should have to be spending $200,000 a year, frequently causing bankruptcy and stress because it's not covered, all the copays and others, because the fact that oncologists can get money, they buy the drug at one price, sell it to the patient another, and split the difference. It's there as a $5,000-$10,000 per treatment per patient. So it breeds a culture of, well, I may not be curing cancer, but I can certainly benefit from it. Now take that same application to people in the system you're talking about. You just mentioned a lot of names. I could add 10 more names to that. But look at each one of those companies. These companies don't have one person who is interested in just the financial survival of the company. One of these companies alone, you mentioned, has over 10,000 employees, and one has over 30,000 employees. So if you're responsible for 30,000 people and you're responsible for board of directors, many of these board of directors are interlocking, and if you have people who have no knowledge of the defense industry, no knowledge of weapons, but they're on your board because they're maybe a banker or something, then you start putting the circle in place and you start seeing the interlocking circle. You're dealing with a lot of people who are all powerful, who are all connected, and they all have some connection back to the military-industrial complex, to front groups, to think tanks, to experts, to lobbyists, to politicians. And you start realizing, gee whiz, what would happen if we said, we're not giving you any more money, we don't want your system unless you can prove to us that that system is absolutely necessary for our survival? How many of those companies would go broke? How many of those people would still have a job? And how much money would we have saved? Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, my thoughts on it is you're speaking exactly, I mean, we really are talking about the same thing. And it's fascinating to me that you can often replace one word with another. And the military-industrial complex is sometimes called by people the military-industrial academic complex. Look at the former director of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, is now running the UC system. I mean, tell me how you can explain that in any other way than the conversation we just had, or what you just said. So, and this idea, I'm not familiar with the medical industrial complex as a journalist, but I'm certainly familiar with it as a civilian. So these are big picture issues, and they have small instances. What I find most interesting and most challenging is to try and locate the individual stories that involve actual people, you know, situations, events, beginning, middles, and ends, to see how, on a human scale, how that drama unfolds, because for someone like me, then it helps me to think about the bigger picture without, without necessarily having to assume that everybody works like that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I want to give you something very specific. This summer, I watched a little tiny film playing at the Lincoln Plaza, which is a small art theater here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And it starred Ethan Hawke. I don't think it had a general release. It was all about a pilot that every day would go into the Air Force Base, go into one of these little bunkers, and sit with about five or six other people. And they were the drone pilots. This is out in Nevada. And then he would be told to watch a particular car or person, and then he'd be told to fire. And he would then have a couple people verify what he was doing, and then he would fire. But then he was being told by people out of CIA headquarters at Langley, and then it started to get to where they were willing to kill innocent people to get to supposedly a bad person. And at some point, he began to question the legitimacy of this. And yet up to that point, he could you know, wipe out some people and go have lunch. No one seemed to be emotionally connected to the outcome of what they were doing, nor the technology. And you're starting to see all this really fancy technology where they can zoom in, zoom out. They can hear what's going on inside of a house. They can infrared. They can see the body images, the heat images of people inside. And on the one hand, you think, wow, isn't that really neat? And then we start realizing there's no proof that person is a combatant. In fact, the rules of war say any adult above a certain age is considered an enemy combatant. And hence, there's a 90 to 10 ratio. 90% of the people killed by drones are civilians. 10% are combatants. And think of what it does when you have a family. In the Middle East, the extended family is about 40 people. So imagine how many people you kill, how many people then that's going to impact, because none of those people's relatives are going to be happy about the fact you may have killed an innocent person, as we just did this past weekend and last weekend. So then you have to ask, does anyone ever bring it home? Do you take what you're doing out there and bring it back to the people giving the commands who are emotionally detached, as you mentioned, even the academics, where everybody can emotionally detach from everything they're doing, even the people dropping the bombs, until someone says, is this really right? And I don't see anyone saying, is this really right? Your thoughts?
Well, in the Pentagon's brain, I take the reader through the different wars that have been fought while DARPA has been overseeing research and development that, in essence, places the technology into the war theater. So you have the Cold War, you have the Vietnam War, you have a long situation that the Pentagon called operations other than war, which we would now maybe call limited actions against terrorists. Then you have the Gulf War, and then you have the war on terror, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then part five of the book is called Future War, because DARPA has plans for wars of the future. So my point of view on all of this is less about morality, that's a different subject for many other great books, and more about the idea that what you see today is decades old. So there's a big disconnect between information and where we're talking about the same thing, I believe, is how people take information and then make judgments about whether it's good or not good, just or unjust, moral or not moral, whether they want to be part of it or reject it, those kinds of decisions, those important human decisions. And I think the point that I make in the book, one of them, is that the information that you have today is already locked and loaded. And and you mentioned drones. Drones would be a great example, because when the drone strikes first became very public in Afghanistan in the war on terror, everyone started having this debate about, you know, warfare at a distance. But in fact, drones were used in Vietnam. They were developed by DARPA starting in 1968. And drone technology, as I write in the book, had this incredibly long research and development effort at the Pentagon by the supported by the first scientist who was the Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown. And people's perception of that was, thank goodness we have a scientist in the, people maybe that were of the more liberal persuasion are saying, we have a scientist in the Defense Department, and they had no idea that what that meant was using science to make war. And so my point is that I think the place where a person becomes empowered, and place where a person can make decisions for themselves and their families that are most valuable, is in the information. So to realize, the more you can know about the information, including how old that information is, where that information has been coming from, is just as valuable as anything, because for someone like myself to get involved in a moral argument about drone strikes right now, I don't feel that I would be very effective, because I feel like my effectiveness is saying, okay, wait a minute, if you want to have a moral argument about drones, how about let me give you some information where you can educate yourself about where it's going next. Because where it's going next is merging man and machine, is creating cyborg drones. DARPA has already created two of them, a rat that they can steer, a moth that they can steer. So where is that taking us in terms of drone warfare, and how will it look and feel when the drones are half animal, half machine, and are semi-autonomous?
They'll have their own reality show with Kim Kardashian as the host.
But this is not fiction. This is real. This is real science and technology.
But
it's actually happening.
But there's the disconnect. There's a big disconnect, Annie, and that is Americans don't feel that any of this is real because they're not the ones starving. They're not the ones in boats leaving Libya. They're not the ones who were involved in the sectarian violence, the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq. They're not the ones hiding in caves. They have not gone through this. So the moment you start having these kind of achievements, they'll be looked upon with praise. The M16 Tomahawk cruise missiles, the Titan, the Javelin missiles, the stealth fighters, the surface-to-surface artillery rocket systems, various reconnaissance contraptions. These are mostly related to conventional warfare when opposing militaries meet the battlefield. You're now telling us that DARPA is making a quantum leap forward to create a generation that, when by the time we find out it's in place, it will be celebrated, in my opinion. It'll be celebrated on Fox News. It'll be celebrated by National Geographic for its technology, because we have managed to separate with pure logic the academic or scientific achievement and knowledge to create something versus ultimate use. I could give a good example of vaccines. We praise the idea of public health measures. We give all the credit to the vaccines for eradicating major epidemics, but then we carefully do the science behind it, which I and others have done, and we see it's lacking. So the military industrial complex will take the advantage of havoc, chaos, untold civilian uprisings around the world, and the regional instability, Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And these countries are going to be perceived as far more dangerous than they were before America invaded them. And I recall during the first Gulf War, only about 5% of munitions were precision guided. And now that we have precision guided, which are not that precise, we're not really that concerned about who we're killing. So we may be precise about can we hit a building, but we don't really care who's in the building. And then we do what's called a double tap, where those who come to rescue those who have been killed, innocent civilians, are then killed also in case there might be one of their comrades still coming in. And so what we have is we have, frankly, in my opinion, the adaptation of the American public to praise, to rejoice, celebrate our technological prowess, positioning it in the idea of, just like we did at the Gulf, we all got popcorn, not all of us, but a lot of people got popcorn and watched as the intrepid reporters, the embedded reporters for NBC, ABC, CNN, all were explaining how the great technology was tearing down Saddam Hussein's defenses. And so we didn't care about the people dying. We don't give a damn about people who die. We could care less about anyone. If they're not us, we don't give a about them. And that's the reality. Now, maybe you find a place in this country that does, then show me their protest. Show me the universities that have gone on strike. Show me the students that have gone on strike. Show me 840,000 physicians that have gone on strike. Show me all the scientists, 6 million that have gone on strike. Show me all the politicians that have gone on strike until we require peace as a tool. But we're afraid of peace as a weapon because we only know how to militarize something. So I'm saying that everything you're telling me, that we're going to end up with cyborgs of one type that we used to think of science fiction, like RoboCop, being the future. And once they're used in the field over there, mark my words, they'll be used right here in the United States, where people will want to have that cyborg at their school in case a bully gets out of place, or want to have one on their street in case there's a drug dealer, or want to have one. I see nothing but a big storm coming on this. Your thoughts, please.
Well, my thoughts are if you and I were at a dinner party, we would be the last two people there. You and I would just be talking it out until the end of the night, until the sun came up, because these are very important, you know, things to think about and discuss. And that what you're saying is, my goodness, if people aren't paying attention, and I'm, forgive me for paraphrasing you, but if people aren't paying attention, we're going to wind up in some kind of dystopian nightmare, which we certainly agree on that. I don't think it's fair, however, to categorize all the drone operators into one collective unthinking bunch. And I say that only because I've interviewed drone operators. I've sat in a drone room in what was called the war theater, because it was at, you know, it was, the drone was flying over Afghanistan. The operator was sitting in a room at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. And I've interviewed drone operators, and I find them to be just like the rest of us in terms of, you know, conflicts and questions and things that they wonder if they are right and they are wrong. I don't think that everyone who works for the military doesn't consider the idea of morality. That's my experience is that people are very
thinking. I agree with you. I agree with you. But I believe that people don't do as much thinking as they do feeling. And the difference is that when I did my documentary, American Veterans Forgotten and Abandoned, I had to go into the woods to find 16,000 American veterans who believed in their cause,
yes,
who thought they were moral people. They would not have killed an innocent person. They would have not have shot a baby. They would not have raped a woman. They would have not have raped a kid. But once they were militarized, once they were indoctrinated, once they were in a theater war that they had no control over, and it was all state of command, where their protests would not have been invited into a room to discuss for change, then something takes over. And that something can be a epigenetic conditioning that causes them to be so disheartened and so angry that frequently their only out is to take drugs or kill themselves. And the reality is, this is not a mere theory. This is not a utopia. This is the reality. 23 American soldiers kill themselves every day. More American soldiers have killed themselves by their own hand than all their casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, and then that's the ones who've killed themselves, and there are 960,000 homeless vets. There's 1.2 million of those vets who are injured today psychologically, whose families are suffering, they're suffering, and the military that told them, be gallant, be brave, we're going there for freedom, and they believe them. These are innocent people, many who thought it was the right thing to do. Now they're broken, and a country's military and government doesn't care about the people that fight your wars. Imagine how little discomfort they would have in challenging its citizens who protest them.
Well, you're absolutely right, but I do write in the book how Vietnam proved the military leaders wrong, and the effect that the protesters had was profound. No amount of military technology, no amount of DARPA technology could win the war in Vietnam, and what ended the war in Vietnam, hands down, was the power of the people. The people saying, get the hell out of Vietnam. And that is a true fact. And in the book, I have that photograph with that exact slogan, one of the protesters holding that up, because that slogan made all the military might at the Pentagon terrified, because they knew its power. And there you come down to that idea that, you know, the voice of the people collectively, the enough is enough voice, is extraordinarily powerful against any kind of industrial complex.
Providing that they are not put into the matrix that if you protest using your freedom of speech, that you are automatically considered no better than a domestic terrorist. In point of fact, that's actually happened. Why? Because we know from Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks, just how extensive the American government's spying and surveillance activities actually are, and how much of this technology is directly related to DARPA. And we know that DARPA is using a new generation surveillance technologies that is nothing like anything we've seen in the past. And so therefore, I fear for those people who are nonchalant, assuming that this will only be used technology to help us, protect us, instead of protecting the organizations, the legislators, the military and corporate interests that need this in order to survive financially. And then look at those like yourself. I'm quite sure you're on everyone's enemies list in the government. I'm sure they have an enormous file on you. I'm sure everything you do is monitored. But thus far, you've been able to avoid any more serious confrontation with them. But if there's something that you're doing that really would offend them or threaten them, I do not believe that you would be as safe as you imagine you are.
Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, DARPA's research and development against some of, I'm going back here to that Vietnam protester idea and going and also linking forward to the present tense, which is that the people, the voice of the people, the protesters were such a threat to the Pentagon that DARPA, then called ARPA, initiated a number of programs that were called non-lethal weaponry. And they began to experiment in research laboratories that were specifically set up in Saigon and in Thailand during the Vietnam War, disguised to look like military research, when in fact they were dealing with how to crowd control, how to, you know, incapacitate protesters. And I write about this in the Pentagon's brain with kind of a spooky eye speaking toward the future, or the present tense, because, you know, many of these programs talk about like the how to imagine in the future. So this is back in 1968, saying they wanted their scientists to imagine in the future ways in which you could disperse these chemical crowd control agents in a manner that no one will notice. And then later in the book, I write about how there are some of these programs with Lockheed drones working to disperse little, and these are all open source, unclassified, but the item that the Lockheed drones are dispersing is not revealed, okay? It's just a sort of prototype. But you see these little bomblets, so to speak, that go out of these Lockheed drones, and they actually have parachutes on them, and they kind of float down, and then they drop whatever it is that they drop. Well, if you can connect A and B, it would not that hard to see that that might be a crowd-controlled agent.
I see. We're coming up to the end of the program. What do you know from your research would be some of the more startling approaches that DARPA is taking in its research? You mentioned briefly the idea of these robotics. And by the way, from their point of view, a robotic would be brilliant because it wouldn't drink, it wouldn't take drugs, it wouldn't kill itself, and it would do exactly what it was told without any conscious equivocation. So what do you see coming at us that we should be concerned about?
Yes, I write this absolutely specifically in the book because it is a concern, and it should be a serious concern, I believe, to citizens who are mindful of this idea that the Pentagon could be moving us toward future wars that are endless wars, so wars that just continue to go on. And the way in which that can be done is if all wars are fought by machines. And there is great pushback in the Pentagon against this. That's what I found the most fascinating. You know, veteran military commanders are against this idea of hunter-killer drones. And the Pentagon initiated through DARPA a program that now addresses what's called robot ethics. And so DARPA stepped in, and part of a program called Narrative Networks, they're dealing with how to influence, you know, storytelling. And this is right at the edge of propaganda. And what I find most troubling is that what it says to me is that when you have pushback at the Pentagon now from, you know, individuals who have dedicated their lives and their careers toward being in the military and who are wise enough to see from where we have come and want to speculate where we should not go, instead, you have a group of technologists, those technological elite that Eisenhower warned against at the Pentagon, saying, let's not listen to this and take it on balance. Let's create a program that deals with robot ethics. Let's get our way and teach robots ethics, which is absurd because robots don't have ethics and they certainly can't learn them.
Also, those individuals who would control the system would also control the ethics. And we know how...
Absolutely. They would build in... You're absolutely right. They would... If you're going to give a robot ethics, and that's in quotes, it's going to be engineered in. It's not human sentience. So you have to tell the robot, these are your ethics protocols. That's not ethics. That's engineering.
And we know what happens when people in power who may be unstable in their spiritual dimension would decide what the ethics of a combat robotic soldier would be. Annie, thank you very much for this outstanding work that you did with the new book on Operation Paperclip, but your latest one on bringing us this insight into the understanding of DARPA. And we look forward to another discussion with you.
Thanks for having me.
And my guest today, Annie Jacobson, and she's done some outstanding work. Her book is called The Pentagon's Brain, The Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. And her website is anniejacobson.com. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.